Plants grow past their unripe stage, in the same way that sober sages give up egotism and possessiveness. These are based on things different from the real self, namely the material body and its byproducts. Purport: the word adishu in this verse indicates the byproducts of the body, such as children, home, and wealth. Text 40. Nischalambura bhuttushnim samudra sharadagame atmanyuparate samyam munir vyuparatagama. With the arrival of autumn, the ocean and the lakes became silent, their water still, just like a sage who has desisted from all material activities and given up his recitation of Vedic mantras. Purport: one who recites ordinary Vedic mantras for material promotion, mystic power, one recites ordinary Vedic mantras for material promotion, mystic power, and impersonal salvation. But when a sage is completely free of personal desire, he vibrates the transcendental glories of the Supreme Lord exclusively. Text 41. Kedare bhyastva pogrihnan karshakadridasethubhi yatha pranai sravajjnanam tannirodhena yoginaha. Translation: in the same way that the practitioners of yoga bring their senses under strict control to check their consciousness from flowing out through the agitated senses, the farmers erected strong mud banks to keep the water within their rice fields from draining out. Purport: Srila Prabhupada comments, in autumn, farmers save the water within the fields by building strong walls so that the water contained within the field cannot run out. There is hardly any hope for new rainfall. Therefore, they want to save whatever is in the field. Similarly, a person who is actually advanced in self-realization protects his energy by controlling the senses. It is advised that after the age of 50, one should retire from family life and conserve the energy of the body for utilization in the advancement of Krishna consciousness. Unless one is able to control the senses and engage them in the transcendental loving service of Mukunda, there is no possibility of salvation. 42. Sharad arkam sujam stapan bhutanam mudupoharat teha bhimana jambodho mukundo vrajayoshitam. Translation: the autumn moon relieved all creatures of the suffering caused by the sun's rays, just as wisdom relieves a person of the misery caused by his identifying with the material body, and as Lord Mukunda relieves Vrindavan's ladies of the distress caused by their separation from him. Text 43. Kamma shobhata nirmegham sharad vimalatarakam sattva yuktam yathachittam shabda brahmartha darshanam. Free of clouds and filled with clearly visible stars, the autumn sky shone brilliantly, just like the spiritual consciousness of one who has directly experienced the purport of the Vedic scriptures. Purport: the clear and starry autumn sky can also be compared to the pure heart of the devotee. The spiritual nature is always brilliant, clean, and blissful, and this spiritual nature, called Vaikuntha, immediately satisfies all the desires of the soul. This is the secret of Krishna consciousness. 44. Akhanda mandalo vyomni raja joru ganeshasi yatha yadupati krishna vrishni chakravrito bhuvi. The full moon shone in the sky, surrounded by stars, just as Sri Krishna, the lord of the Aru dynasty, shone brilliantly on the earth, surrounded by all the Vrishnis. Purport: Srila Sanatana Goswami explains that in Vrindavan, the full moon is eternally risen, and this full moon is like the full manifestation of the absolute truth, Sri Krishna. When he was manifest on earth, Lord Krishna was surrounded by prominent members of the Vishnu dynasty, such as Nanda, Upananda, Vasudeva, and Akrura. Text 45. Ashlishya samashitoshnam prasuna vanumarutam janastapam jahurgopyo na krishna hrita chetasaha. Except for the gopis whose hearts had been stolen by Krishna, the people could forget their suffering by embracing the wind coming from the flower-filled forest. This wind was neither hot nor cold. Finally, text 46. Gava mrika khaga narya pushpinya sharada bhavan anviya manasvai vrishai falai risha kriyaiva. By the influence of the autumn season, all the cows, doe, women, and female birds became fertile, and were followed by their respective mates in search of sexual enjoyment. Just as activities performed for the service of the Supreme Lord are automatically followed by all beneficial results. Purport. Srila Prabhupada comments, on the arrival of the autumn season, all the cows, deer, birds and females in general become pregnant, because in that season, generally all the husbands become impelled by sex desire. This is exactly like the transcendentalists, who by the grace of the Supreme Lord are bestowed with the benediction of their destinations in life. Srila Rupa Goswami has instructed in his Upadeshamrita that one should perform devotional service with great enthusiasm, patience and conviction, and should follow the rules and regulations, keep oneself clean from material contamination, and stay in the association of devotees. By following these principles, one is sure to achieve the desired result of devotional service. For he who patiently follows the regulative principles of devotional service, the time will come when he will achieve the result, as a wife's reap results by becoming pregnant. Narayana. In preparing for this class, I was feeling a little intimidated, one by the setting here where there are so many legendary senior devotees living in this community, and I'm sure many are also watching on the internet, and especially Maharaj, also Adhanavan Maharaj is present, so it's impertinent for me to be speaking in front of all of you. So I will request your blessings and permission to speak something about these verses. Another challenge today for this class was there are so many verses, 8 shlokas, and many different subjects are covered. And also, these verses have been explained in different places. We have the purports here, which are by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada who completed the Bhagavatam, team of Hridayananda Maharaj and Dravida Prabhu and Gopi Puranadana Prabhu. So they took up the task of finishing the remaining chapters of the 10th canto and the 11th and 12th after Srila Prabhupada's disappearance. But Srila Prabhupada also gave us the Krishna book very early on in ISKCON's history. Prabhupada had the foresight that consider that he may not live long enough to translate all the cantos of Bhagavatam. And he especially wanted to give the devotees access to Krishna's pastimes. So he translated Krishna book very early on. So the devotees would have access to Krishna's pastimes, would be able to learn about Krishna, his personality, his activities, and in that way increase our attraction for him. And we can see particularly that Srila Prabhupada didn't complete the 10th canto. He finished up to the 13th chapter. So we're very fortunate that he had that foresight to give us the entire Krishna book, even before translating the other cantos of Bhagavatam. Generally, it's recommended one should read the Bhagavatam in order, from the first canto to the 12th canto, progressively. And the first two cantos are compared to the lotus feet of the Lord. Just like when we have darshan of the Lord or have darshan of any superior personality, we're supposed to first see their feet and gradually raise our vision towards the face of the Lord. So in the same way, one is supposed to first go through the Bhagavatam in order. So by the time one comes to the 10th canto, one will be sufficiently educated in Krishna's position to understand his personal activities. Otherwise, there's a fashion of people to just hear Krishna's leelas and without really understanding Krishna's supremacy and Krishna's powers and his position, to simply focus on Krishna's pastimes in a superficial manner. Srila Prabhupada would often criticize this method of hearing Bhagavatam, the professional reciters who only focus on Krishna's pastimes without being sufficiently purified by hearing the other cantos of Bhagavatam. So when Srila Prabhupada gave Krishna book, he did so not just focusing on the pastimes exclusively, but also weaving in his purports in the very text of the Krishna book. So he gave us the stories of Krishna along with the purport in one text. So This chapter, rainy season and autumn, has been described by Srila Prabhupada in Krishna book. And not only in Krishna book, also there's a special book, Light of the Bhagavad, that Srila Prabhupada wrote just on this chapter. Very interesting composition with the paintings by the famous Chinese artists. It's very beautiful artwork, and Srila Prabhupada has given special commentary on these verses in that book also. So we have multiple sources of information for this chapter, and also, of course, there's the commentary of the Acharyas. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has also commented on the entire Bhagavatam, including this chapter. So there are many different subjects covered in these verses, and many different references to expand upon them. So I thought I would just very briefly go over some of the verses which haven't been expanded on much, and then concentrate on a couple of the verses which have more more information, more purport. So the first verse was 39, and the comparison was given as in the autumn season, the mud starts to harden because of the rain stops, so the mud in the land dries up, and the plants also start growing past the unripe stage. In Mayapur, in India, we have six seasons, so the rainy season is very visible, 2 months of rainy season, and everything is very muddy all the time. So it's, I think in other countries, perhaps the experience is not the same. The rains are interspersed in, throughout the year or in different seasons, but in India, there's a very solid 2 months monsoon rainy season. When Krishna was performing his Vrindavan Leela, this rainy season was prominent. And now, after the rainy season, the autumn season started, and the plants are starting to grow and the land is starting to dry up from all the rains. So the example is given in the same way: the sober sages give up egotism and possessiveness, which are based on the body and the byproducts of the body, children, home, and wealth. Yesterday there was a little discussion about family life in Krishna consciousness. So here it says that the sages have to give up these attachments to children, home, and wealth. So there is, the Varnashram system is very scientifically structured, that there is a time for everything. And the Grihastha Ashram is supposed to be between the ages of 25 and 50. And that's the time when one focuses on one's family, on one's career, on one's children especially, to raise them up nicely. And after the age of 50, one is supposed to wind down those activities by entering the Vanaprastha Ashram. And then text 41, Srila Prabhupada also expands on this. After the age of 50, one is advised to retire from family life and conserve the energy of the body for utilization in the advancement of Krishna consciousness. So this principle, pancha sordhvam vanam vijayat, once one crosses the age of 50, one is supposed to, literally it says one should go to the forest, vanaprastha ashram. And of course there are different stages of that vanaprastha ashram. Basically it means that one, by that time one's family responsibilities should have been completed. If one has married at the right age, then one's children will be grown up by the time you're 50. And they'll be married, they'll be settled. And your major responsibility to your children is completed. So then you can conserve your energy, conserve your time, and focus on Krishna consciousness in a more wholehearted manner. So the example is given in that verse 41. Just like in the autumn, the farmers have to conserve all the water that has filled up the fields, because there won't be much rain coming in the autumn. So they have to create barriers around the field so the water remains in the field. In the same way, the practitioners of yoga, they control their senses, especially at this time, this vanaprastha stage. They check their consciousness from flowing out through the agitated senses. So we know in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the example of the tortoise who withdraws his senses from the sense objects, just as the tortoise withdraws its limbs within the shell. So this is an important principle of vanashram life, to withdraw from the active duties of the family once one reaches a mature state. So this was text 42. 41, and in text 40, similar description is given, that the oceans and lakes become still, the water is no more agitated from the rains and from the streams. Just like a sage who has desisted from material activities and given up his recitation of Vedic mantras. So this is a little interesting concept, that the sage should give up recitation of Vedic mantras. The purport explains that these are ordinary Vedic mantras which are meant for material elevation or impersonal salvation, mystic powers. So these mantras are not required for a devotee. When a sage is completely free of personal desire, then he vibrates the transcendental glories of the Supreme Lord exclusively, as is given in the purport. There is a story in the Mahabharata about this principle of saving the water in the field. So there's one brahmachari who was studying the ashram of his guru, whose name was Ayodhya Dhomya, and the disciple's name was Aruni. So as we know, even from Krishna's own pastimes, all the children of the higher castes were sent to the Gurukul to study under the teaching, under the teacher, to study Shastra and also to perform menial service. So Gurukul was not simply a school where one goes in the morning, learns some academics and goes home. But many years of training, both academic and practical and spiritual in character, to mold these students into a first-class human being. So the ashram was run like its own self-contained village. So the students had many different duties to do, looking after the cows, cultivating the fields, collecting firewood, cooking, and their studies also. We know in Krishna's pastimes how he was caught in the storm with Sudama while collecting firewood for the ashram. So in this story also there is a similar instance where this disciple, Aruni, he was coming back from the field from collecting firewood, and he saw that it was raining and there was a big stream of water that was about to flood the fields. So too much water is also not good for the crops. So he was trying to repair the breach. He could see the water was trickling in. He was trying to pat the mud and make it strong to protect the field from the excess rain. But he was alone and he wasn't able to patch the hole. So he devised a very ingenious and difficult way of protecting the field. So he didn't come back that night, and they noticed that Aruni's not back from the forest, and there's a big storm going on. So the guru was very concerned, and he took a few disciples out to search for Aruni, just like Sandipani Muni also took his disciples in the morning to search for Krishna and Sudama. So they were searching and calling out for him in the rain, and eventually they heard his voice very weakly saying, "Gurudev, I'm over here." And when they saw him, they saw that he'd actually laid his body on the edge of the field. So he's physically with his own body protecting the field from being overflooded. And so the guru was so overwhelmed with his sacrifice that they immediately took him home, and the other students, with all of them together, they managed to fill the breach. And he got very special blessings from his spiritual master, and he became known as Uddalaka Aruni, which means the one who was raised from the breach. There's a similar story in Western, in fable of the boy from Harlem who plugged the dike with his finger. In the Dutch story of, the Holland is below sea level, so they have all these dikes built to keep out the ocean. And the little boy was coming home one evening, and he saw there was a trickle coming through the crack in the wall. And if the wall was breached, then the whole village could be flooded by the ocean. So So he stuck his finger in the hole and stayed there, you know, for many hours to protect the village from being flooded. So this it's interesting. There are many, many similarities and a lot of Vedic stories and a lot of the Western fables. So the principle was that he sacrificed to save the village or save the fields. So in the same way, the yogi is supposed to check the senses from rushing out towards the sense objects. Now this is one of the basic principles of yoga. Nowadays, yoga is very popular. Not only nowadays, but even when Srila Prabhupada first came to the West, there were so many. It was a new and very novel concept. Yoga and yogis from India were coming and preaching. And mostly, as it is today, yoga is, you know, by the layman considers yoga to be some kind of exercises, stretching and different postures and asanas to increase one's health or to reduce weight or to reduce stress. This is what the common people think is yoga, and that's actually how most of the yoga societies run. They train people in the various asanas and mainly for physical benefits. But Srila Prabhupada would always stress that yoga means actually to concentrate on the Lord. Yoga literally means connecting. Even in Bengali, jog means addition. When you add one number to another, it's called, you know, yoga, jog. So it's to connect with the Supreme Lord. And that's a spiritual process. It's not a physical, as Prabhupada would say, gymnastics. So there are so many yoga societies now. Last month we had the chance to visit the Bahamas. Radhanath Maharaj had a retreat, Bhakti Yoga retreat it was called. It was actually sponsored by the Shivananda Yoga Ashram in the Bahamas. And you know, quite a few devotees went to attend Maharaj's retreat. But side by side they have many, many, perhaps 50, 60, up to 100 young people from all over the world who come there to the Shivananda Ashram to study yoga. So it was a very interesting experience for us as devotees to visit this ashram and to see how they teach the yoga and how they live their run their ashram and live their ashram life. It was a nice experience actually, and all the more so of course because we were there for, you know, for Krishna, for kirtan and for hearing about Krishna from Maharaj. But we also got to observe the ashram activities. And so they have quite a strict schedule, just like we have, you know, Mangalarti 4:30. They also have a 5 a.m. meditation, and they have, you know, silent meditation. So we would sometimes pass by and see them, you know, sitting there meditating on not sure what, but, you know. Ultimately, they're impersonalists, but they're not. The founder of that ashram is Swami Shivananda. I wasn't able to find any instance where Srila Prabhupada criticized him, whereas we know Prabhupada was very strong, speaking out against, you know, many of the other so-called swamis. But Shivananda Swami seems to be a genuine spiritualist, and although he may not have the full understanding, personal conception of the Lord, but they were very, very nice people, very accommodating, very open to hearing about Krishna, very open to chanting Hare Krishna also, and very popular. They had so many people coming to study yoga from all over the world. And the ashram itself was a very beautiful, very sattvic environment. They didn't allow, you know, any of the regulative principles to be broken. And if you sign up there, you have to attend the 5 a.m. program and the evening program and many classes in the day. They actually have people who come there to volunteer and actually pay to volunteer and work in the kitchen, you know, clean the grounds. It's a very nice spiritual atmosphere right on the beach. And it's made even more, the atmosphere has increased in one sense because just a few hundred meters away, there's this massive casino resort. It's unbelievably, you know, huge. It looks like it's going to like sink the island. It's so big, called Atlantis. And it's just, you know, few minutes walk. You can see it. And in the evening, actually, when they would have their performances, you could hear the whole ashram would shake from the, you know, from the drums, from the music. And so it's a real contrast. This very beautiful sattvic ashram dedicated to spiritual cultivation, and then this huge, you know, tamasic, rajasic casino, resort, hotel place, very nearby. But ultimately, yoga should be to connect with the Lord. And, you know, I can't really say, but I don't think that most of the people coming there were really had a spiritual motivation. You know, as in the world, most people learn yoga or perform yoga to get some physical benefit or as a career even. It was a little pathway that was leading out of the ashram. So I went for a walk one day and I saw, like, littered with cigarettes. So it would appear that people go there, you know, they're not allowed to smoke in the ashram, but they go outside, you know, just outside, and it's a little place there where the cigarettes are all over the place. So real yoga means to control the senses and to withdraw the senses from the sense objects. So that's why the Ashtanga yoga has 8 different levels. And the first, yama and niyama, are rules and regulations of withdrawing the senses and controlling the senses, do's and do nots. And then asana, the yoga asana, is also it's a valid method, and controlling the breathing by pranayama. But ultimately, the purpose of yoga is to realize the Lord. So unless one comes to that platform, then one's yogic practice will always be incomplete. It'll remain on a very shallow, superficial level. Whereas in these verses, it's talking about how the yogis have to control their senses and fix their mind on the Lord. Text 42, there's no purport in text 42, it's talking about the autumn moon, which relieves the suffering from the heat. And the example is given as Lord Mukunda relieves Vrindavan's ladies of the distress caused by their separation. So, although here there's no purport, but Srila Prabhupada has given explanation in Krishna book and light of the Bhagavad about this verse, because Krishna actually has a rasalila on the full moon of the autumn month, the Sharadiya Rasa Yatra. So this is actually particularly referring to this Rasa Leela, where the gopis are relieved from their separation from Krishna by engaging in that autumn Rasa Leela with him. So it's a very beautiful meditation. This is the it comes in October this year. It's October 19th, around that time, the full moon of autumn. That's when Krishna performs one of his rasalilas with the gopis. So they get relieved of their distress from seeing that autumn moon and having the rasalila with him. Text 43 talks about the sky, which is full of beautiful stars and free of clouds. And just as the spiritual consciousness is shining of one who has directly experienced the purport of the Shastra. So Krishna Chakravarti Thakur expands on this analogy. He says that the sky is the heart, and the absence of clouds is purity. So when the clouds are covering the sky, then everything becomes dark and gloomy. But in the clear sky, then the moon shines very brightly, and the stars are compared to Nishkam Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Tapa Yoga. The moon is compared to Bhakti. So when the clouds are absent, in other words, when one is purified, then everything becomes very bright and shiny and clear and clean. Now, Srila Prabhupada would always comment that, you know, when the devotees dress in Vaishnava clothing with tilak and shaved head and saris, and when they're following properly the process of Krishna consciousness, they're very effulgent and beautiful. So this is evident also in this shloka. The spiritual nature is always brilliant, clean, and blissful. And this spiritual nature called Vaikuntha immediately satisfies all the desires of the soul. This is the secret of Krishna consciousness. Text 44 compares Krishna to be the moon, and he's surrounded by stars of all his associates in the Yadu and Vishnu dynasties. Text 45, again it's talking about the gopis. They were not satisfied by the cool wind blowing from the forest, from the flower-filled forest. They were never satisfied. Whereas the other
people, they would feel some relief from the heat, feeling the cool breeze in the autumn. But the gopis were always agitated by separation from Krishna, so they were not satisfied by that breeze. And then text 46, quite a few interesting points in text 46. This is the verse that talks about how the female animals became fertile and pregnant in this month of autumn. Just as activities performed for the service of the Supreme Lord are automatically followed by all beneficial results. So Srila Prabhupada talks about the first verse of Upadeshamrita, not first verse, sorry, second verse, I think. Utsaha nishchayadharyat tat karma pravartanat sangatyaka sato vritte. Is that right? Shadbhir bhakti prasiddhyati. So if we follow the principles of devotional service, then as mentioned in this verse, the results will automatically come. So what are those results of devotional service? There are different descriptions given in different shlokas, different shastras. What are the results of performing devotional service? In the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it says that by performing devotional service, automatically one gets detachment and knowledge. Vasudeve bhagavati bhakti yoga prayojita chanayat yasu vairagyam jnanam cha yadahaitukam. So when one takes up devotional service, one automatically gains knowledge and detachment. Then another side effect of devotional service is given in Nectar of Devotion. Klesha gni shubhada moksha laguta krit sudurlaba sandrananda visheshatma shri krishna karshani chasa. This is a list of some of the benefits of performing devotional service. Klesha gni is the first one, which means one's distresses are destroyed. Shubhada, everything becomes auspicious. Shubhada moksha laguta krit. And liberation doesn't seem to be very important anymore. Sometimes people come to spiritual life, to Krishna consciousness, seeking relief and wanting to get liberated from their sufferings. So that comes very easily if one performs devotional service properly. And the idea of moksha is not very attractive to a devotee. He'd much rather engage in positive devotional service than some kind of impersonal liberation. Sudullabha devotional service is also very rare. Just like here it talked about the rain in the autumn. So actually this is one of the comparisons to this rain in the autumn is the human form of life. That it's very rare to get the human form of life, just as it's very rare to get rain in the autumn. So once one has that human form, one should take full advantage of it and take up devotional service. Sandrananda visheshatma, that one becomes full of bliss by performing devotional service, and ultimately one's attracted to the Lord, and one attracts the Lord. This is another byproduct or goal of devotional service. And another example in this regard is from the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. The verse Srila Prabhupada would often quote, Bhakti parishanu bhavo viraktir andyatra chaisha trikeyaka kala prapadyamanas yathashnatasyos tushti pushti kshurapayonukhasam. So as an example is given, just as like when one eats, three things happen simultaneously. Tushti pushti and kshurapaya. One's hunger is relieved and one gets nourishment and satisfaction. So when one takes shelter of the Lord, then three things occur. One develops devotion to Him, one has direct experience of the Lord, and one develops detachment. So in the purport of this verse, a very interesting point is raised, that the verse is virakti. Virakti is detachment as opposed to tyaga, which means renunciation. So tyaga means when you give up activities, you give up everything, basically. Whereas we know that in our process of Krishna consciousness, our acharyas have, Rupa Goswami has stressed yukta vairagya, which means engaging everything in the Lord's service. So that's virakti. Virakti means detachment, where one can be involved with material objects, material situations, but one can use everything in the service of the Lord without attachment. So that's the difference between tyaga, when one actually gives up everything, and virakti, or yukta vairagya, where we can engage everything in the service of the Lord. When we understand that actually nothing is ours, everything belongs to Krishna, so we can use it for his service. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada would say, when the devotee would say, oh, I'm going to give up this or give up that, Prabhupada would say, it doesn't belong to you in the first place. How can you give anything up? You should just use it all in the service of the Lord. So this is the special advantage of performing devotional service. One doesn't need to give up anything. Just like the yogis, they try to withdraw their senses and concentrate in a more mechanical manner. Whereas devotees, we have a much easier way of engaging our senses and mind. We come to the temple, we engage our eyes in seeing the beautiful form of Radhishyam, Krishna Balaram Gornitai. We engage our sense of smell in smelling the flowers, smelling the incense. We engage our tongue in chanting Hare Krishna and taking prasadam. We engage our body in devotional service and dancing in the kirtan. So we have a very nice, easy, practical process of performing devotional service, of engaging one's mind. Especially in this age, the yogic meditation is not recommended in Kali Yuga. It's very hard to follow, not recommended, but by chanting Hare Krishna, by engaging one's senses in devotional service, one gets the full benefit of all spiritual practices. So Prabhupada says here that if you follow the process faithfully, as Rupa Goswami has instructed us, then naturally the time will come when you will get the result. So Srila Prabhupada would often, especially in his letters, he would sign off his letters, I hope that you and the other devotees are faithfully following the program, chanting your rounds, following the principles. If you do so, you'll be guaranteed of success. There must be dozens or hundreds of letters that Srila Prabhupada signed off like this, and he also stressed this point many times. So one may wonder, now where does it say in the scriptures that if you chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulative principles, you go back to Godhead? Does it say anywhere, can anyone find a reference? The four regulative principles actually are just the standard of civilized human life. They're not even spiritual principles. Now, chanting Hare Krishna 16 rounds, 16 rounds is like a real minimum. Is it really that special, these instructions of Srila Prabhupada? Is it really possible that just by chanting 16 rounds and following the regulative principles, following the program, one can go back to Godhead? So it's true, you won't find any shastric evidence of this particular points. But because Srila Prabhupada has said that so many times, Srila Prabhupada has promised the devotees, that if one does this, one will go back to Godhead. Therefore, Krishna, he's obliged to actually fulfill Srila Prabhupada's promise. Sometimes Krishna is known to not necessarily be so truthful or not even follow his own promises. But if a devotee makes a promise or a devotee makes a vow, then Krishna is obliged to fulfill that. So Srila Prabhupada is the most intimate surrendered servant of the Lord. So if Srila Prabhupada has promised us that if one follows these principles, one can go back to Godhead, then Krishna definitely has to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's instruction to us. Of course, it's not mechanical also. One has to chant Hare Krishna not offensively. One has to try to purify, concentrate on the words of the mantra and gradually purify himself. So it's not a mechanical thing. One simply offensively chants rounds. Even after many births, one may not go back to Godhead or get love of Godhead. So it takes some qualification, but the principle that if we follow very strictly the process given by Srila Prabhupada, and by following strictly, we will purify ourselves, we will get that taste for chanting Hare Krishna, and then Krishna will take care of the rest, as Srila Prabhupada has ordered us. So these are some thoughts on this section of verses. One last point which I wanted to make in text 45, when it talks about the gopis who were suffering in separation from Krishna, there's no purport to this verse, but in the light of the Bhagavad, Srila Prabhupada talks about this mood of separation. And we know in our line, mood of separation is given a lot of emphasis. And in light of Bhagavad Prabhupada expands on this, and he says actually the mood of separation is much more relevant for us. We're living here in the material world. We don't have access to Krishna. We can't see him face to face. We can't enter into his pastimes. So cultivating the mood of separation is very natural for us, because we have that. We can cultivate that hankering or that longing to see Krishna, to participate in his pastimes. But in this present condition, we don't have the facility to actually have union with him. Therefore, cultivating the mood of separation is very relevant for us and appropriate. And of course, even those great devotees in our line who, like the Goswamis, who actually could see Krishna face to face and have direct communication and witness his leelas, they were also in the mood of separation. So it's very much our being very chaste to our sampradaya, our paramparas, to embrace this mood of separation and always try to act in a way, as Prabhupada would say, don't act in a way that you want. Don't try to see Krishna, but act in a way that Krishna will want to see you. So if we please Krishna by our devotional service, then one day we'll get the result of that service, as Srila Prabhupada has promised us, and we can enter into his eternal pastimes. So I'd like to stop here, unless anyone has any comments or questions. Oh, yes.
Sometimes in the early days of the movement, grihasthas would want to take sannyas, and Prabhupada would say, you're already more than sannyas. So, if someone is in that situation, how do we understand vanaprast? It would seem to be a step down. Or is there any, you know, we have many grihasthas that are either fully engaged or engaged every moment that they're not engaged in maintaining their families. So what transition would be there? I think we can understand a transition if someone is preoccupied most of their life with maintenance and raising their family, but many devotees are engaged as far as possible. So would there be a transition? I mean, they sell their house and, you know, go on the road, live in a van, or what is that necessary? What does vanaprast actually mean? And how does it look externally?
Mm. Yeah, it's a good point, because vanaprast ashram is the greatest of the ashrams as far as, you know, in ISKCON. You know, we have very clear duties for a brahmachari, grihastha life, you know, that's the norm almost these days. And sannyasis, we have quite a few examples. But vanaprastha is a little bit gray in that sense that, you know, you're still married, you're not wearing saffron necessarily, and it's not so clearly delineated how it works in the modern context. You know, in the Vedic times, there are four levels of vanaprastha. I think they're mentioned in the seventh canto. And there's like a gradual reduction of the association between the husband and wife. The children are already supposed to be independent by then. So yeah, it is something that I think devotees, as now we have many devotees in that stage of their lives, and they're finding their own ways, I guess, to kind of go back to more direct devotional service. That's the beauty of the Vanashram system, is that the brahmachari life, you're fully dedicated to following the order of the spiritual master. And the grihastha ashram, you may be slightly distracted by family duties, but once those are completed, then one can again fall back on the brahmachari training. So as you said, it may mean that, you know, you stop, you know, if you don't need to work anymore to maintain your family, you have enough savings that you can just live very simply. We see the devotees moving to Mayapur and, you know, concentrating on their sadhana or traveling and preaching, as you said. You know, there are so many different ways one can use that extra time very nicely in devotional service. And there's a big field for senior grihasthas who are now technically vanaprasthas, though we may not necessarily call them that. But basically, once your children are grown up and settled, you are a vanaprastha by default almost. You know, so I think, you know, you can probably speak more from your example. You have many godbrothers in that stage. And traveling and preaching, you're also doing that yourself, so I think you can also share with us some of your thoughts.
I have one thought that sometimes it's difficult to pull out of a situation you've been in, let's say 25 years.
Sure.
And you've built things up and maybe out of the loop, so to speak. And sometimes it can be a challenge to get back to the basics.
Mm. Definitely.
And as you said, there's a whole world out there waiting for people with 30, 40, 50 years of experience in life and Krishna consciousness who desperately need it. And I would pass that message on to devotees here, that there's so many people that need your association, that will welcome it, will take care of you in so many ways if you give your association. So I think, you know, everything was with Prabhupada was preaching, so what does vanaprastha mean? It means more time for giving Krishna to others and, you know, reducing your own necessities so you have more time. Something like that.
I wanted to comment on that. I've only had first initiation, and I was associating with people in Indianapolis. They were building a Hindu temple. And they were having a home program, one Bhakta Dan, he was a medical doctor. And they were installing deities in their home, Radha and Krishna deities, and they asked me to do the arti because I was the most senior person there. And I was embarrassed that I didn't even know how to do it. So I've come back here to seek that kind of training because there's a whole world out there waiting for people like us.
We find that the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita are based on a Varnashram setting. But at this point, it seems like the whole Varnashram system has become completely null and void within the world. I mean, we're trying to reintroduce it back and reestablish it back. And to some degree, it is, or some of it, especially the ashram part, is somewhat successful, but the varna part is still, you know, we're still hovering over. Coming from India, are they doing something to try to reestablish? Are they training devotees in this area? I mean, you can give us some insight into that.
Yeah, it's true that Varnashram, it's not very developed. And Srila Prabhupada himself noted that. And towards the end of his pastimes, he started to stress on establishment of Varnashram, having a system where people can make gradual progress. Because he saw that devotees weren't necessarily able to maintain the transcendental platform for, you know, for the long haul. He saw that some of the householders were leaving their partners, some of the sannyasis were leaving the sannyas ashram. So he saw that devotees were not necessarily as transcendental as, you know, they hoped to be, or even as he hoped them to be. So then he started to stress that Varnashram is very important to have a very solid, gradual way of progressing from brahmachari to grihastha to vanaprastha to sannyas. So he himself stressed that, and it is a big field that needs developing in ISKCON. Mostly people work it out for themselves, you know, in their own lives, but on a broader scale, there is a lot of work to be done. I don't really have much more to add to that. It's also quite late. I think we should stop here. Kantarashma Bhagavatam ki, Shlopropa ki.